when big business turns into big activism. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, April 6th. So glad you could join us this evening. Let's start with that question of big business and activism. North Carolina has been taking heat recently for a law that forbids transgendered people from using bathrooms other than those assigned to their biological sex. It's also preventing local governments from passing non-discrimination laws in order to protect LGBT people. Now, as a result, PayPal canceled a planned office in Charlotte that was worth 400 jobs. And CEOs from Apple to Yelp to IBM to Cisco and Facebook are all lobbying for the law's repeal. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, it's no coincidence that so many of these businesses are tech companies.
IBM, Apple, Yelp, Airbnb, Lyft, Salesforce, they've all called for the repeal of North Carolina's law. Netflix actually said it would stop producing shows in Georgia if that state passed legislation viewed as anti-LGBT.
These laws make it much more challenging to attract and retain workers.
Dina Fidas is with the Human Rights Campaign. Tech companies in particular have a challenge when it comes to recruitment.
Tech talent is at a premium and is perceived as in very, very short supply.
China Gorman is a consultant, and she says these companies depend on people and attracting them. Competition for talent among tech firms is incredibly intense.
There's another layer here, and that's corporate culture.
Tech companies also tend to have very inclusive corporate cultures. John Sumser is principal analyst for HR Examiner.
There's an extraordinary level of tolerance, even encouragement of difference.
In part, he says that's because these companies believe diversity improves problem solving. China Gorman, the consultant, says the strongly tolerant corporate culture makes it hard for many companies not to say something.
Leaders and organizations have choices to make. Are those really our values? Is that how we really relate to our people and relate to our customers? Or are they situational and not so much?
More than 90 companies, and not just tech businesses, are calling for North Carolina to repeal its law. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Today, pharmaceutical giant Pfizer announced that its tax inversion deal with Ireland-based Allergan is gone, baby, gone. It was killed by new rules from the Treasury Department that make it much harder for all American companies to move their headquarters overseas to avoid taxes. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein digs into whether the tax inversion itself is dead.
President Barack Obama has made it plain. He wants companies to stop heading overseas for tax inversions. Height Securities, Henrietta Trays.
Inversions are significantly harder now than they were 2 days ago.
In essence, Treasury makes it more difficult for U.S. companies to find the right foreign partner and makes it more difficult for U.S. companies to lower their tax rate after an inversion takes place. According to an estimate from Congress, all but ending inversions and clamping down on the practice known as earnings stripping would generate $90 billion in additional tax revenue from corporations over the next decade. USC professor Edward Kleinbard says Treasury's proposed rules don't go that far.
What Treasury did is definitely worth tens of billions of dollars to tax revenues. It's south of 90 and north of 10.
There's little doubt that this week's move from the federal government will have some kind of chilling effect on inversions. But attorney Gordon Kaplan suggests it's foolish to start writing any obits.
I am highly confident that there are very smart people all over this country that are experts in this area looking at the regs very carefully and coming up with other strategies that will work for the next deal.
Kaplan says the reality is Treasury did what it can do. He says to solve the tax inversion problem, where billions of dollars leave this country, Congress must take on meaningful tax reform. Something, he says, a large swath of businesses, including Silicon Valley and the Chamber of Commerce, are pushing for. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The Fed minutes from March are out, and it seems like, and I know this is a surprise, or maybe it's not, there is not much appetite to raise rates this month. On Wall Street today, a little up, a little down, but mostly up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been 14 years of the inescapable influence of this. Don't even try to pretend you don't know what that sound is. American Idol is saying goodbye. The two-part series finale starts tonight, and whether you are cheering or crying as Idol takes a bow, the power of that one show, the money it generated, the careers it launched, really can't be overstated. Here to talk about it is Adrian Hill. She covers entertainment for Marketplace. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Molly.
Okay, so American Idol, has there been another show that has such an economic halo? I mean, we'll talk about the cultural implications, but weren't a lot of people in a lot of different areas making money as a result of this show?
Yeah, American Idol was really printing money for Fox and the show's creators and some of its stars. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in ad revenue, millions of dollars in iTunes music sales. There were live Idol tours and brazen product placement. You probably remember, if you've seen Idol, those giant red Coke cups always sitting in front of the judges.
But it also changed the whole TV landscape, right?
It really did in so many ways. So Survivor and The Amazing Race were on the air before American Idol. So was The Real World. But when Idol blew up for Fox, reality TV shifted into high gear, especially the TV talent show. Networks were scrambling to figure out what to put on the air against American Idol. They were scrambling to find their own version of it. And more than a dozen singing competitions sort of sprang up in its wake. Lots of them short-lived, you've probably never heard of. And some successes, you know, Nashville Star, X Factor, The Voice, which is on the air now. In so many ways, the show changed our relationship with television.
Wait, it changed our relationship with television? How's that?
It did. We were in charge. We could vote. We, the audience, could decide the outcome. And Molly, fess up here. Did you ever vote? Have you ever voted in American Idol?
Maybe once or twice.
I'll admit, happily admit to casting a vote or two for Clay Aiken back in 2003. In many ways, American Idol ushered in this whole new way of interacting with television. Television stopped being a passive medium. There were times when Idol would get more than 120 million viewer votes in a week, which are nearly presidential election numbers. Kind of mind-blowing if you think about it.
Yeah. And so then what impact did that have sort of broadly on our culture?
The magic of American Idol, I think, was the potential for any of us, any of our neighbors, to be a star. The dream that somebody would finally see me for the talent that I am, maybe a dream that all of us have, was really front and center in American Idol. And I think there's a good argument to be made here that that belief that stardom could be sort of self-made and based on talent instead of connections really helped bolster the YouTube culture, the YouTube generation, which didn't even exist when American Idol was created.
Well, and that's not the only tech tie-in, right? You could also argue that American Idol changed our relationships with our phones.
Yeah, there's this fascinating. American Idol, it seems, based on some informal polling that AT&T did, so let's take this with a grain of salt, but the show introduced a lot of folks to sending text messages, which is kind of wild. Here's Ryan Seacrest actually explaining to people how to text in an early season of the show.
Just go to message screen, type in vote, V-O-T-E, and send it to Idols01, no space, just Idols01, kind of like this, and then send.
Go to message screen. That is where we all begin. AT&T found in this poll that 22% of people said they learned to text in order to vote on American Idol, which is remarkable in its own sort of world-changing lesson.
Yeah, no kidding. Also, I wish you all could see the video so that you could get a load of the phone that Ryan Seacrest is actually using. That's Marketplace's Adrian Hill. Thanks so much, Adrian.
Thanks, Molly.
You may not know this. I actually did not until very recently. Law enforcement officials have the right to take your property or cash if they think it's related to a criminal act. They don't have to charge you with a crime. They can just take the stuff and they don't always have to give it back. In fact, the U.S. Justice Department recently announced that it's resuming a program that lets local police departments keep up to 80% of the assets that they seize. That's got some people wondering if there's a financial incentive for police to take your things, especially since civil asset forfeiture, as it's formally known, has been on the rise. From WABE in Atlanta, LEU reports.
I want to eat orange chips. It's not even done.
It can be done.
In their Florida coast home, Alda Gentile tries to get her four-year-old grandson, Daniel, to sit and eat his lunch.
Come here.
Let me get my laptop first.
Okay, get your laptop. 4 years old is getting his laptop.
Gentile moved to Florida about 3 years ago from New York. She was working as a limo driver then and says she wanted a change. So she, her son, and one-year-old grandson at the time drove down to scope out some condos in Florida, taking about $12,000 in cash. They didn't find a place at first and began a drive back home.
This is when the nightmare started. Carl, we were singing Itsy Bitsy Spider to the baby. And suddenly, we see sirens came out of nowhere.
Police stopped them across the Florida border in South Georgia, allegedly for speeding. She says for hours, officers made them sit by the side of the road while they questioned why she had the money and asked if she was a drug dealer. They eventually seized her cash, even though they didn't find any drugs in the car. She was never charged with a crime.
I was so baffled at the whole thing. And I remember thinking that you guys are not police officers. You're just pirates with badges. That's what you remind me of right now.
Gentile got her money back a week later and eventually sued the police. But in Georgia and some other states, officers can seize money and property from people under suspicion without charging them with a crime. It's a process known as civil forfeiture. Some say police in states with stricter laws can also get in on the cash through a federal program known as equitable sharing. It allows local law enforcement to keep up to 80% of assets seized in conjunction with the federal government. The money can be used for things like bulletproof vests or patrol cars, and critics say that creates a profit motive.
Now, everyone agrees that law enforcement should be fully funded. The question is whether or not law enforcement should have a financial incentive in taking people's property.
Wesley Hoddit is an attorney with the Institute for Justice, an organization fighting for civil forfeiture reform. He says asset forfeiture has exploded over the last decade. In 2014, the Justice Department seized about $4.5 billion. And he says it can be hard for people to get their money back because it costs too much to hire a lawyer.
They don't have the money to fight. They don't have the will to fight. Many people simply give up.
Officials say the program helps to punish criminals involved in money laundering and organized crime. Kendall Day is with the U.S. Justice Department.
You need to both attack and prosecute individuals at the same time you take away the instrumentalities of crime and the proceeds of crime. That's the only way for a sophisticated transnational organization that you're going to make a dent.
Those in law enforcement say most seizures are justified, and if things do go awry, there are remedies to allow for people to get their money back. Louis Degmar is with the International Association of Chiefs of Police.
I can tell you that professional law enforcement and policing, you know, is committed to doing right by its citizens, but also at the same time ensuring its communities are protected.
The DOJ last year limited its equitable sharing program under Attorney General Eric Holder to address concerns of abuse, but critics say that's not enough. Meanwhile, lawmakers in some states are working to restrict civil forfeiture laws to allow someone to be convicted with a crime before losing their money. I'm Ellie Yu for Marketplace.
Coming up,
kids almost romanticize it. Like, hey, I had Tommy John. I'm a real ball player now.
Why that guy Tommy John should be on your mind next time you watch a baseball game. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 112.6% to close at 17,716. The NASDAQ picked up 76 points, 1.5% to finish at 4920. And the S&P 500 added 21 points, 1%. It closed at 2066. Don't you feel good? It has been a day for deal busters. As we mentioned, fallout over inversions ended the merger plans of Pfizer and Allergan. No one was too broken up over that breakup. Pfizer shares improved 5%. Allergan added 3.4%. Johnson & Johnson rose 0.4%. The Department of Justice filed suit to block Halliburton's bid to buy oil services firm Baker Hughes on antitrust grounds. Halliburton gushed up nearly 6% as a result. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.75%. And you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Let's take a turn toward tech. The big trend in technology is connected devices, things like the smart home, gadgets that all talk to each other so you can remotely control your garage door or your lights or your alarm system. The market is still new, and one of the earliest devices that could control your smart home was a gadget called the Revolve. It was pretty smooth, popular enough, actually, that Nest Labs bought it, and now they're turning it off. A note on the Revolve homepage told people that as of May 15th, their $300 Revolve smart home hubs, the actual hardware in their houses, won't work anymore at all. So now what? Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Earlier this week, Arlo Gilbert wrote a blog post. It said this: on May 15th, my house will stop working. He's been founding tech startups for about 20 years and calls himself a home automation nut. He owns a Revolve smart home hub. He says he doesn't think the shutdown is malicious, but the circumstances give him pause.
You know, had Revolve itself shut down, I don't think anybody would be angry. I think we'd be disappointed. But the fact that it's owned by this mega corporation is what's infuriating.
A couple of years ago, Revolve got bought by the Alphabet Corporation, you know, Google. As a result, all of the Revolve devices run on proprietary servers. That's what's being shut down. Robert Scoble writes about technology and owns a Revolve hub.
We knew that this specific device was very interconnected and to work properly required other devices, and that's all good and done. We didn't understand that Google could remotely turn it off.
That's what Revolve customers are upset about. It's not like the device doesn't work anymore.
It's a business decision. I doubt it's some sort of compatibility decision.
Evan Kaplan is CEO of Influx Data. They provide back-end technology for connected devices.
And what you'd hope in these sort of situations is the people who have the hardware would get an automatic free upgrade to whatever was coming next. That's what you'd hope.
Arlo Gilbert says the company reached out to him on his blog to try to help.
Because I made some noise. When I think what they should be doing is helping everybody who bought a product from them, not just the one who's making noise about it.
Because the investment isn't just $300. It takes a lot of time to set it up. And after you program it, the device contains a lot of your personal data. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Look, I try to stay away from cliches as much as the next radio host, which is to say, I use them when I need them. And come on, the image of the dairy industry, it's unavoidable. You're thinking Wisconsin, cheese hats, the happy cows here in California. But in fact, I'm here to tell you, you should be thinking Saudi Arabia. Yep, that country has some of the largest farms in the world. And it takes a lot of food and water to keep those cows happy. That's kind of a problem when you live in the desert. And so the industry relies on a lot of imported crops, like alfalfa, that, as it turns out, mostly comes from the U.S. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jed Kim reports.
Say you're in Dubai and you've got a sudden hankering for yogurt. It'll probably come from Saudi Arabia.
If you travel throughout the Gulf, you'll see Saudi dairy products all over the place.
Jean-Francois Sesnec is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Feeding Saudi cattle isn't easy, especially since the government announced it'll stop growing all fodder within 3 years to save water. That means imports.
If they need food for this cattle, well, maybe it's worth the money because they have to feed the darn things, and it may make some sense to bring it somehow by container loads to Saudi Arabia.
Africa looked like a potential growing field. In 2009, about 150,000 square miles of land changed hands. But Robert Tashima at the Oxford Business Group says most of those deals haven't borne crops.
There were only probably about 20% that had actually made it to the farming stage, even a couple of years later.
Because of infrastructure problems or questions of ownership. That may be why Saudi dairy company Almarai is buying land in Arizona and California, 14,000 acres so far.
The higher upfront costs of investing in someplace like Arizona or California are warranted because they have fewer challenges to face.
Much of the land will be for water-intensive alfalfa in a region in the midst of a record drought. In California, the Saudi land is within the Palo Verde Irrigation District, which has senior water rights along the Colorado River. Richard Gilmore is assistant manager of the district.
We have that number one priority, and we get what we need.
Which makes it likely that Almarai, as one of the district's customers, will get what it needs. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
The new Major League Baseball season is back. Fresh green grass, all new players, a promising crop of pitchers. And a lot of those pitchers are coming in hurt. Some have already had the dreaded Tommy John surgery. That's the increasingly common procedure that repairs the elbow injuries that pitchers seem to get all the time. In fact, those injuries and the surgery are becoming way too routine. And baseball loses about $500 million on injuries, including elbow injuries, every year, despite spending more on pitchers than basically any other athlete in any other sport. Yahoo Sports baseball columnist Jeff Passan has a new book out called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sport. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Molly. Thank you for having me.
So how common is Tommy John surgery now in Major League Baseball?
Well, more than 25% of players have it on Major League rosters. It's actually as high as it's ever been. John Rogley, who tracks these things, estimated at 26.9% this year. And in addition, there are another couple dozen players on the disabled list, and of those, 40% have had them. So it's fairly common throughout Major League Baseball with pitching. It's becoming even more common at the youth level.
Right. And you say in your book that a pretty shocking number of Tommy John surgeries are being performed on not just young major leaguers, but regular kids, too.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Within the last, over a recent five-year period, 56.8% of Tommy John surgeries were performed on teenagers. Now, this used to be a procedure that was limited strictly to major leaguers. You never saw this with kids. And a lot of that has to do with how much they're pitching and how hard they're throwing. And when you combine those two, it turns into a really big problem for the long-term health.
Well, and it feels like it's a pipeline problem, right? You're saying Major League Baseball spends $1.5 billion a year on pitchers, but they've got kids coming in who've already had surgery. What does that mean for future contracts?
It doesn't mean good things, because the greatest predictor of a future arm injury is a past arm injury. And when you have kids who have had Tommy John surgery at 15 or 16 coming into Major League Baseball and into the professional system, the idea that they're going to make it to 30 years old before they need another surgery is unlikely. It just is. Most of these surgeries last somewhere between 7 and 10 years. One of the players I follow, Daniel Hudson, blew out his ligament for a second time 11 months after the first. So the fact is, when you have damaged goods coming in to the major leagues, they're just ticking time bombs. And it's a generation of players now who are going to be coming in having gone through this system where pitching a lot at young ages is encouraged and where throwing at maximum velocity is a premium and where the incentives for both parents, coaches, and kids are just backward.
Are teams keeping information about injuries to themselves, like research that could be beneficial to the sport as a whole?
Absolutely. It's one of the things that they're trying most to do, or at least the smartest teams are. For example, there's a doctoral student at Northwestern who just graduated named James Buffy. And Dr. Buffy spent his time looking into the forearm muscles and how they can stabilize the elbow. Dr. Buffy went and got hired by the Los Angeles Dodgers, of course, and so they're going to be siloing his research, and it's not going to be out there for everybody to benefit from. It is very true that if a team can figure out how to keep pitching healthy, it will have a distinct competitive advantage over the other 29 teams. And that's one of the motivating factors behind it. They understand that health is the next frontier in baseball.
How much of this problem was exacerbated by over-reliance on the surgery? I mean, it sounds like Tommy John surgery itself is almost an industry.
Yeah. There are doctors out there who will do the surgery when it doesn't necessarily have to be done. And look, they get paid for those surgeries, and they get paid a pretty fair penny for them. And so, you know, when players are going in, it's sort of sad the way that the teenagers these days look at Tommy John surgery. More than 50% of them think that it's going to make them throw harder. And kids almost romanticize it. Like, hey, I had Tommy John. I'm a real ball player now. And what they don't realize is this is surgery that takes a minimum of a year to get back from. And that's with pitchers who have some of the best athletic trainers in the world working with them every single day on this protocol. And so it's not a romantic thing. This is a bad thing. Just because it has a fancy name doesn't make it some boutique procedure.
That's Jeff Passan, author of The Arm. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
This final note before we go, we have held back the drone invasion for a while, but today word that a panel created by the FAA suggests that commercial drones should be allowed to fly over populated areas. Right now, the FAA only lets drones fly over empty fields or houses or things like that, commercial drones anyway. And filmmakers and news organizations, even construction companies, want clear rules that will make commercial drone use more flexible. So this federal commission, which includes, yes, drone makers, but also pilots and airports, says that as long as the devices fly at least 20 feet above people and never get within 10 feet during takeoff and landing, why, what could go wrong? And that's it. That's all we have for today. The Dow gained 112 points today, 0.6%. The Nasdaq was up 76 points, 1.5%. And the S&P 500 added 21 points, or 1%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer this program for us. I'm Molly Wood. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.